want more than you have, you think you need. And when you think more than you want, your thoughts begin to bleed. I think I need to find a bigger place. 'Cause when you have more than you think, you need more space. Society, you're a crazy breed. I hope you're not lonely without me. Society, crazy indeed. I hope you're not lonely without me. Less is more. But if less is more, how you keeping score? It means for every point you make, your level drops. Kinda like you're starting from the top. You can't do that. Society, you're a crazy breed. I hope you're not lonely without me. Society, crazy indeed. I hope you're not lonely without me. Society, have mercy on me.
It would seem that for children today, a toy cannot be fun if it doesn't do anything. A toy that just sits there and depends on the child to do something to it is boring. But what has actually happened is that the child's imagination has withered. Children who never had toys that do the play for them are rarely bored. Boredom is actually a kind of withdrawal symptom from the addiction into the ever-intensifying sensual stimulation provided by today's electronic toys, games, and media. The TV show is over. I'm bored. Play some Game Boy. I'm sick of that now. I'm bored. Eat some cookies. I'm full now. I'm bored. Moving from one stimulus to another, the mind develops a higher and higher tolerance to stimulation, and so the dosage must increase. Video games that are even more exciting, television that is even faster paced, more dramatic. Thus, movies and television programming have, over the last few decades, become increasingly fast-paced, the editing faster, the scenes shorter, the special effects more dramatic. Old movies are kind of boring, aren't they? Boredom is the beginning of the mind's healing process. Like any withdrawal symptom, it is painful, but very soon latent, undeveloped abilities of the human mind start to manifest. Without diverging into a long discussion of the benefits of meditation, silence, and solitude in nature, suffice it to say that children and adults alike benefit from situations that provide the raw materials of creativity and models of creativity, but leave the process of creativity up to the individual. This is also how people learn. The ability to learn constitutes yet another form of spiritual capital that has become grist for the money machine. Boredom is a defining characteristic of modern society for another reason. It represents a hunger for authentic experience. The consumer economy takes advantage of this hunger by selling us artificial experiences of greater and greater variety and intensity. Television and video games are attractive because they temporarily assuage our hunger for experience. Yet at the same time, they are a primary contributor to the separation from reality. Because they are more lurid, more dramatic, and louder than real life becomes boring in comparison. The child becomes so adapted to the extreme stimuli of electronic entertainment that he or she loses sensitivity to more subtle sensations. Also, because the barrage of stimuli in electronic entertainment is so rapid, the child's attention span shrinks to the point where he is incapable of patient, sustained observation. In order to command viewer attention, programmers put a technical event, a zoom, frame shift, new object, into television content every few seconds, engaging the neurological orientation response, also called the startle effect. It is subject to habituation and thus requires increasing intensity over time. Effects more violent, louder, more dramatic, more shocking. No wonder reality is so boring. Compare today's bored, jaded teenager with the piraha described in Chapter 2, who are enthralled watching a boat slowly appear from afar and disappear over the horizon. Today's commercial entertainment embodies the sell-off of our very wonderment at the slow, subtle processes of nature. What is a chick breaking out of a shell compared to cartoon dramas in which the fate of the universe is at stake every half hour? I will never forget a trip I took with my wife and children to the aquarium in Baltimore, Maryland. The place thronged with parents dragging their hyperactive children from one exhibit to another. But most of the children simply weren't interested in looking at the fish. They'd look for a few seconds, then run off, pulling their parents' clothing. Even the sharks failed to hold their attention for very long. Then at one tank, I heard a chorus of voices, children's and adults, saying something about Finding Nemo. Here, finally, was a spark of interest from the children, but it came from a movie. Apparently, one of the fish was identical to a character in a popular children's movie that takes place in a coral reef. The fish in this story were rendered in lifelike 3D animation, and you can bet that the events of that movie were far more exciting, far more stimulating than anything you could see in a fish tank. No wonder the children were bored. Reality is boring. My aquarium experience illustrates a profound phenomenon, the conversion of experience, that is life, into a consumer product. This is the ultimate conversion of spiritual to financial capital, because it means that being in self, the experience of living, costs money. Paid specialists, usually strangers working for enormous organizations, create the life we experience. Of course, it has not yet come entirely to that extreme, but consider, whereas once children would go out into the forest, lake, and field to experience nature, now the experience is packaged and sold to them in the form of an aquarium or nature TV program. By this process, nature is transformed from part of life into a spectacle, even as we rely on others to provide our experiences. In yet another realm of life, we have become consumers. The conversion of life into something that is consumed means that we pass through it instead of creating it for ourselves, which increasingly amount to little more than to go somewhere and look at whatever is provided and listen to whatever is said. Or we put them through the motions of some prescribed, programmed sequences of actions in imitation of the creative process, converting learning into the following of instructions. A couple of years ago, I was a driver for a school field trip to a llama farm. The children were not allowed to touch the animals, their feed, or anything else. All they did was look at the llamas and listen to the employee tell them information. None of them asked any questions, for they were not interested. In fact, it took quite an effort on the part of the teachers to keep order and restrain the children's natural curiosity and desire to explore. They might as well have been watching a program about llamas on television, though I suppose they at least got to smell them. Our town has a children's parade every year, but the children are not in charge of the parade. They merely walk through it, carrying cardboard animals on poles or dressed in costumes created by someone else. I have witnessed crafts that children are trotted through at Sunday school and daycare, which consist of children doing as they are told, step by step, sometimes without even understanding what they are doing, and rarely taking any pride in their finished work. Indeed, it would be too messy, too chaotic, to let the children loose with the raw materials of creativity. Of course, creativity must be constrained to a controlled area and result in a predetermined product that is not creativity at all. It is labor. No wonder the children are so lackadaisical, so unmotivated. They are preparing for an adulthood of following instructions. They are preparing for an adulthood of work, of labor, of being functionaries of the machine. Your creativity will be constrained to a controlled area and result in a predetermined product. Is that your job description, too? One of the most pernicious manifestations of the control and therefore elimination of play has come through organized sports, which started with Little League and extend today into all sports and all age groups. The sandlot, the playground, the neighborhood, and the vacant lot. Where children were once free to hammer out their own rules, choose their own teams, and resolve their own disputes, have been replaced by yet another supervised realm, where play means going through a prescribed set of motions and where the social interaction is mediated and guided by authority. In a way that children do not play the game at all. The game plays the children, who are just accessories, placeholders fulfilling functions determined by rules created and enforced by adults. Here, play has lost its essential creative nature. I do not know what to call it, but it really is not play anymore at all. It is, however, an excellent conditioning method for producing people who look to authority for instructions on how to play the game. Have you ever felt like you are still one of these placeholders fulfilling functions determined and enforced by some unchallengeable authority? Have you? Then, of course, there is school, which plays a crucial role in the loss of all forms of capital, social, cultural, and spiritual. Here again, children progress through a more or less preset sequence of steps, the curriculum. Here again, children progress through a more or less preset sequence of steps, the curriculum. Their natural desire to explore and create, confined to specified times, places, and subjects. They read about the world without experiencing it, reinforcing the notion that knowledge comes from the absorption of information, facts, and data provided by authority. And belittling all the while the very idea that they are competent to really learn for themselves through first-hand observation. The restrictions we place on children arise out of two related concerns, safety and practicality, both of which boil down to some version of control. It is not as safe to let your children roam the neighborhood or the forest as it is to keep them at home. Prefabricated programmed experiences are safer than real experiences in the world, which is beyond the human realm of predictability and control.
Much as it pains me to stop listening to Charles Eisenstein's book, we're going to have to leave it there on grounds of time. I'll explain at the end of the show how you can download that whole audiobook as a separate item if you like. Now, this is a recording from ABC Radio National in April 2010, and it starts with Richard Louv reading from his extremely successful book, Last Child in the Woods.
If when we were young we tramped through forests of Nebraska cottonwoods or raised pigeons on a rooftop in Queens or fished for Ozark bluegills or felt the swell of a wave that traveled 1,000 miles before lifting our boat, then we were bound to the natural world and remain so today. Nature still informs our years, lifts us, carries us. For children, nature comes in many forms, a newborn calf, a pet that lives and dies, a worn path through the woods, a fort nested in stinging nettles, a damp, mysterious edge of a vacant lot. Whatever shape nature takes, it offers each child an older, larger world, separate from parents. Unlike television, nature does not steal time. It amplifies it. Nature offers healing for a child living in a destructive family or neighborhood. It serves as a blank slate upon which a child draws and reinterprets the culture's fantasies. Nature inspires creativity in a child by demanding visualization and the full use of the senses. Given a chance, a child will bring the confusion of the world to the woods, wash it in the creek, turn it over to see what lives on the unseen side of that confusion. Nature can frighten a child, too, and this fright serves a purpose. In nature, a child finds freedom, fantasy, and privacy, a place distinct from the adult world, a separate piece. These are some of the utilitarian values of nature. But at a deeper level, nature gives itself to children for its own sake, not as a reflection of a culture. At this level, inexplicable nature provokes humility.
I love that line, inexplicable nature promotes humility or offers humility. I think that's a very powerful idea. What do you mean by it? What is at the essence of that?
You know, when I was really little, when I was, some of my first memories are of feeling that sense of awe and wonder that hopefully most children have the chance to feel when they crawl out through the weeds to the edge of the yard where the trees begin and first turn over a rock and find perhaps for the first time that they're not alone in the universe, and hearing wind in the trees and voices that are either there or are not there, but still we hear them. That humility that we feel when we find that world, which is larger than our parents and their problems, and that gives us humility, and it also gives us strength.
Journalist Richard Louv's book called Last Child in the Woods, Saving Our Children from Nature Deficit Disorder, seems to have spearheaded a growing movement. He's chairman of the Children and Nature Network in the USA, mobilising communities to re-engage children with the natural world and address what he calls a kind of cultural autism as a result of our sensory deprivation from green spaces. And he's been in Australia this week for the inaugural International Healthy Parks, Healthy People Congress in Melbourne. Richard Louv, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Tell me about the four-story treehouse that you built, you and friends built with your very own little hands at age 9 or 10, because in a sense it's emblematic of what you're up to now.
Yeah, well, I was no good at sports. I tried. But the woods and the field behind my house, I lived on the edge of the suburbs outside of Kansas City, Missouri, and I could go through my hedge into the cornfield where my underground fort was. That was terrific, too. And then from there on into the woods and the fields that seemed to go on forever. Those were my woods. I owned those woods. They're in my heart now. They were in my heart then. And to the extent, I felt this sense of ownership to the extent that I pulled out, I think, hundreds of survey stakes that I knew had something to do with the bulldozers that were taking out other woods nearby. But down in those woods was this huge old oak tree. And I pulled together my own team of kids. And
construction workers, not kids.
Well, small, very short construction workers. And we, of course, took a lot of lumber from the houses that were being built. They'd never do that. They'd shoot you now if you took this stuff. But they kind of meant it for the kids then. And we'd haul all that lumber down and built a four-story treehouse, huge thing. You could only get into it if you went through the basement or the roof. You couldn't get in. So you either had to go in through this little hole, little trap door, or you had to climb up the limbs on the outside of the treehouse all the way to the deck on top and then go down it. And it was so cool. And
it was cool and it was lethal, and that was part of the attraction probably.
I guess it was lethal. I guess we could have fallen, you know. But one of the interesting things now that pediatricians say is that they don't see very many broken bones among children anymore, at least not in the United States. What they do see are repetitive stress injuries, which comes from too many hours spent with a video game or at a keyboard, at a computer, carpal tunnel syndrome, that kind of thing. That's among little kids. And that kind of injury tends to last a lot longer than a typical broken bone, which used to be a kind of rite of passage.
Looking out from the top of that treehouse, 40 feet high, I gather, what do you think that treehouse, in a sense, represented to you and your psychological development as a little being?
That's a really good question. I think it represented a lot of things. I think it represented creativity. It represented strength because you had to be strong in certain ways to create something that big. But it also represented a view of the world that was higher, that you really could only have if you were near the top of a tree. And I mean that literally and metaphorically. And that's one of the things that nature gives kids in terms of that independent, self-directed play, which is the, really the source of what's called executive function, the psychological phrase for self-control.
I think a lot of it is to do with this image of the child, that if we perceive children to be in need of constant protection rather than feeling that they are active participants who have their own rights, we're constantly going to want to protect them from what we perceive as might be a dangerous place. If we believe that they can actually make decisions about the sorts of things that they're doing, it's a much better place to be in terms of early childhood education.
And in terms of the creative life of the developing mind, it seems too. Deb Moore was a preschool teacher for more than 20 years, now working in local government in Victoria. And for her recent Masters of Education, she interviewed children in two preschool centres about their impressions of the play spaces. But what she stumbled on was a whole other secret world of the child's imagination, which she calls the secret business of children's secret places. And she's been sworn to secrecy.
The adult perception of a play space now is often highly structured playground equipment type place that has the rubber matting underneath so the children are not hurt and doesn't have loose material so that stones can't be thrown and doesn't have rocks that children may fall from. And in fact, some of the children that I did some research with in the less natural play space showed fear about some photos I showed them. There were some rocks and logs, and they said that that was a dangerous place. So it does seem as if they really are taking on what adults are telling them, that it is not safe. I've heard many stories about parents not even letting children out to their letterbox out the front of their own houses, or parents who do let their children ride their bike to the local park ride in their car behind them so that they're constantly watching them. So the barriers are real. Children are feeling increasingly supervised, and I think their need to create these secret places is becoming more in some ways because of that increasing supervision.
Well, perhaps they don't know any difference.
Well, that may be true, and there has been research on an innate intrinsic need to be secret. Yes, okay, it's universal that children want to make those secret places, and they need to be their own places. As I was told by one of the children in my research, that only children can make secret places. She was very clear. Actually, a number of children said something similar, but she was incredibly clear that adults can grow the plants and provide the loose materials, but the children have to make their own secret places.
And when you discovered secrecy was an important thing, tell us about what kids were creating. What sort of things did you unfold with them?
Often it was just using a bush or a shrub or a tree that they would sit behind or in the middle of, and it was their perception of being hidden completely. And as one other child said, lots of people walk through this secret place but they don't know that that's what it is. So it is their own unique construction of that secret place. The one in particular in the centre that had a lot of habitats for wildlife, there were a dense bamboo thicket, and a number of children used that as their secret place, but at different times, so that they had their own portals in and out that were protected. Mm-hmm. Their special places were often a swing or a climbing equipment, but the secret places tended to be the natural elements, like a tree. And then bringing in loose materials too, so that they were creating their own environment themselves.
So what did they look like?
Well, I commented to one other child, was this a secret place? There was mud, there was water, there were bricks and logs. And this particular child said, no, that's not very interesting at all. So really, I can't tell you as an adult what every secret place is going to be like. They're so unique, essentially, that one child's perception. Another child mentioned that the teacher knows where they are, but she doesn't know that it's a secret place. I think it's this symbolic element of secret places became very apparent as well.
So in a sense, kids don't have a lot of physical control over the way they live or occupy the world, but they do have some internal control. They have some control over how they perceive the world and imagine the world. Mm. What were kids doing in secret spaces? Because, you know, they're surrounded by children most of the time. What were they actually saying about what they got up to in their secret space?
Well, there was one child in particular who said, and I quote, "It's very peace and quiet because it's a little hole, so no one can see me, not one little bit."
I just love that picture you've got of her too, because yes. No one can see her, not one little bit, and there are these two little legs poking out of the foliage.
That's right. But she was very happy to just sit in there, and she often spoke about inventing things in her secret place, that it was a place of quiet contemplation, and she was very aware that she used that time to create things and think about things and be imaginative in her thinking and her play. So another child who had a secret place on a pile of rocks, open to everybody, and he would often just go and sit there. And this was a child who was incredibly active in all sorts of other play, but was also very aware that he needed to just sometimes sit and ponder.
What do you think the existence of a secret space brings to a child's play and the psychological experience of that play?
I think it adds a whole other dimension to their play, and it's more about being able to be responsible for the choices that they make, that they feel that they are able to make changes in their own environment so that they're not just being constantly directed by adults that this is the place that we want you to play in. They feel as if they have the right to make the decisions. One of the children in my research was very clear about saying that he could make his own secret place, that he could change things, that he could just do it, he said to me. And that was just a really significant comment that he made, that it wasn't about constantly being told this is where you will play and this is how you will play, that the children have those choices themselves and they're making those decisions.
Deb Moore, an early childhood educator. We're going wild with the imaginative child on All in the Mind, going global on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia and as podcast with me, Natasha Mitchell. And back to writer Richard Louv, who's founded the Children and Nature Network. Nature means many things, and in a sense it helps us to understand what we're talking about. What do you mean by nature in this quest?
Well, again, that's a very good question, and nobody's really answered it well. There's no accident that we've mainly left the definition of nature up to the poets. Science has a hard time defining that. A few years ago, I worked with a dozen or so neuroscientists who were experts on the creation of brain architecture in young children. And I would ask them, well, you know, you've studied all these other things, how daycare affects it, how early parenting. Have you looked at how the natural world affects the architecture of the brain in early development? And they would look at me with this blank look in their face, and they would say, what do you mean, nature? I said, well, you know, to the neuroscientists, I say, you know, this isn't brain surgery. Make up come up with some 150 trees per acre. I don't know, but shouldn't you be testing how the natural world affects the development of young children? And the irony was they were creating in the lab what they considered natural conditions. They were testing animals and what stressed them out and the effect of that. And they would put animals in one environment that's highly stressful and then in another environment that the scientists considered natural. So they were already doing it, but only in a lab and only on lab animals. Mm. The leap to think beyond the box, to think about the natural world itself, to me, that's the problem. I mean, that's why there's not nearly enough research on this issue. And it has to do, I think, with who funds the research in the United States. Is, you know, you have a lot of people that have their own interests in mind in terms of selling pharmaceuticals, et cetera. I'm not against pharmaceuticals. But, you know, we have to wonder why there's been this huge gap in the research. We study how everything else affects child development, but we haven't really studied how the natural world does very much at all.
Though, Richard Louv, that is changing to an extent, isn't it?
Yes, it is. In the last decade, there have been a number of researchers, like Francis Kuo at the University of Illinois, and others who have done great research. And some of that research, by the way, is being done in Australia. The research, for instance, correlating myopia, nearsightedness, with how many hours kids spend indoors looking at screens.
And I've featured that on the show, as well as Francis Kuo's work.
Yeah, and Francis and others at the University of Illinois have done research on attention deficit disorder and found that just a little bit of time in nature, a walk through trees, a view from their room of nature rather than a man-made environment, will reduce the symptoms of attention deficit disorder. And there's much more going on in terms of the research, finally.
It makes it provocative that at the very time, Richard, that the diagnosis of attention deficit disorder or attention deficit hyperactivity disorder has been on the rise in a dramatic, exponentially dramatic way, you came up with a provocative term, nature deficit disorder. Obviously, you saw a sort of correlation there.
And people knew exactly what it was when they heard it. The phrase is corny, but it proved to be very powerful.
And I guess to push the point home, at one point you said that the woods of your childhood were the Ritalin of your childhood.
Yeah, the woods were my Ritalin. And that's true. I'm sure that I would have been placed on some kind of stimulants like Ritalin or something else as a child. I was the kid that sat in the back of the room and looked out the window and daydreamed watching the trees move. And I was the one that was too active in class and had to move around a lot. And I was also the kid that went down and found snakes underneath the hedge at the school and really came alive when I was outdoors in nature. And I can tell you that over the last few years, moving now internationally, I cannot tell you how many parents and teachers have come up to me and said that Johnny and Judy are different kids when you get them into nature. And oftentimes the teachers will say the troublemakers in class become the leaders in a natural setting. And I've heard that over and over. Now that's anecdotal, but the research would certainly indicate that that's based on a reality that is out there. I'm not against pharmaceuticals. I'm not a radical on Ritalin. Some kids need medication. But in the United States, some schools, 40% of the boys are on Ritalin. What are we thinking? What are we doing? Surely that may have something, at least some of those instances, may have something to do with the fact that we took nature away from them in the first place.
Give some dimensions, some behavioral dimensions to nature deficit disorder. It's a metaphor. It's not but it could be. I mean, if we think about the diagnostic bible that psychiatrists use, I could see nature deficit disorder turning up in the appendices at some point. But give us some behavioral dimensions.
I don't know if it'll turn up in the canon.
So much else does.
And in some ways, I'm not even sure that would be a good idea, strangely enough, because it really is more of a metaphor. I think of it actually as more of a disorder of the society than any one child. But I think what it means is, what price do we pay as organisms when we are distanced from nature, when we're alienated from nature? I think this goes very, very deep. It's not just a matter of some behavioral tics. It is who we are. It is part of our humanity. E.O. Wilson at Harvard talks about his biophilia hypothesis. That hypothesis is that we are hardwired to be emotionally attached to nature, and that when we don't get it, we don't do so well.
Controversial hypothesis, but provocative and evocative.
You know, it went through a period of controversy. It's not that controversial now. I think we all know that biologically we're all still hunters and gatherers. We've not changed biologically that much. And some of this just has to be common sense. You know, I make the argument that I'm impressed with some of the science that has surfaced on this issue. We absolutely need more research on this. On the other hand, not every argument is made entirely based on science. Some arguments have to be moral arguments. And those come from deep down inside us. We know what is right at some level. You know, if we'd waited for 1,000 studies to be done on civil rights, there would not have been a civil rights movement. Some of the science can be pointed in the direction you want it to be pointed to, too. And it was on race, for instance. But deep down, we knew what was right. And I think deep down, we know we need the natural world, not just as a source of energy to power our cars, but as a source of energy for ourselves, our brains, for our souls, our very beings, that we have a right to that part of our humanity.
I was interested to read that D.H. Lawrence talked about the mind in nature. He contrasted between what he described as a know-it-all state of mind outside of nature and something different happening to the mind that interacts with the natural world. What did he mean by the know-it-all state of mind? I think that's really interesting.
Yeah, I love that passage. He was writing about his experience of New Mexico. I had a park ranger tell me about the four corners of New Mexico, Arizona, Utah, and Nevada, that nowhere on Earth, or few places on Earth, with so much of the past so close to the surface. And the know-it-all state of mind just assumes we've seen it all, and, you know, when we travel, been there, done that. And what he was saying is that we can be fooled, we can fool ourselves into that belief, but underneath the surface of wherever we go are larger stories. And I think that when you're in a natural environment, you feel that more than any place else. I feel that natural history should be as important to a region's identity as human history, and that our sense of meaning and purpose and connection and place comes from natural history, not just human history.
Richard Louv, which makes it interesting that you describe the know-it-all state of mind that D.H. Lawrence gives us as a vulnerable state of mind.
When you think about, you know, I use that in the context of kids. Teenagers, kids go everywhere now and they think they know it all. It's the know-it-all state of mind. I certainly had that at that age. It's a natural time that you go through. But to some extent, our culture is stuck in the know-it-all state of mind. Our culture has stuck itself in a condition that really belongs to adolescence. You know, and it's because, I think, in large part, because of this alienation from the natural world.
What then do you think is at the heart of that alienation? Because it's all happened very fast. I mean, in my lifetime, and I'm a Gen Xer, I had free form and free range of my neighbourhood, and there were pockets of bush and wilderness and in the city. So what's driven that alienation?
There are several reasons. One is urban design. Parents, kids get lectured all the time to get away from the tube. And in so many cities, so many suburbs, where are you going to walk? You know, so many of the new developments in the United States, and I assume that's true in Australia, there isn't any place. You know, it's one house after another house after another house with yards the approximate size and utility of grave plots. So partly it's urban design. Partly it is our feeling as parents, almost a fetish, that we need to enrich every moment of our kids' lives. And that's well-meaning. I certainly felt that as a father. But we have forgotten that nature itself, particularly independent play in nature, is enriching, perhaps the most enriching thing we can do. I mean, Suzuki violin lessons can come later, but you need that independent play.
You also point to a more psychological phenomenon, not just a material phenomenon, and that is fear, a kind of core essential fear that's come within the life of a generation.
That's the number one thing that parents talk about, that they are scared to death of stranger danger. Now, what's interesting is when you look at the statistics, you'll find that the actual number of child abductions by strangers has been going down, at least in the United States, for two or three decades. What's been going up is the amount of coverage on 24-hour news channels of a handful of terrible crimes against children that get repeated again and again and again. That's the very definition of conditioning. I'm not saying there's no danger outside your front door, or even no danger in nature. That's one of the attractions of nature, actually. I am saying that we need to think in terms of comparative risk. Yes, there's a little danger out there, but there's a huge danger from child obesity. I mean, pediatricians now saying that children this generation may be the first in our history to have a lower life expectancy than their own parents. That's a huge risk. A risk to their psychological health, a risk to their sense of community, perhaps even a risk to democracy. Believe it or not, to develop a sense of community, you have to go out the front door and know your community. And nature is part of that community.
But there's also fear of nature. A point that you make, which is slightly paradoxical, is that the rise in environmental education and this generation's sort of awareness of global environmental issues has perhaps compounded that kind of estrangement from nature.
Well, certainly I hear from folks who have camps, et cetera, kids come on school buses for field trips that tell me that over and over again, the kids get off the school bus and they're terrified to get off the sidewalk, terrified of the lions and tigers and bears. They really believe there's lions out there. Now in the mountains of San Diego, there are, but but there's another kind of fear, though. And Glenn Albrecht in Perth has come up with a phrase for that, solastalgia, which is this kind of deep homesickness for nature itself. We miss it at some deep level. And the fear of the loss of that nature is always there. There's another phrase for that that David Sobel at Antioch in the United States uses, is ecophobia. That's the fear of environmental destruction. And Sobel makes the point that we are programming our kids too early, way too early, to believe that the earth is over, that nature is at an end.
Because kids are carrying a sort of sense of doom, impending doom into their future.
Yeah. And there's nothing wrong later with talking about those things, but in their formative years, these children haven't even had a chance to go out and have that sense of joy and wonder and just playing in nature, just digging a hole in the backyard just for the fun of it, of finding a turtle. Those kinds of experiences, they're having less of those, and they're being told more and more at the same time that nature is dying. So if we do that too much, too early, for the rest of their lives, they associate nature with what? With fear and destruction and the end. That's not exactly going to produce good conservationists and environmentalists in the future. It's not going to create really happy people in the future either. We're missing two-thirds of the story. And the two-thirds of the story that we're missing are that because of those great changes, because of climate change, etc., everything in the next 40 years must change. To any self-respecting, creative 16-year-old, that could be good news, and we better be entering one of the most creative times in human history. That's exciting.
You're appealing to the collective imagination there. If we come back to the individual, you make the interesting point that, in fact, we can increase the safety of our children if we let them out the door, if we let them into nature. Just unravel that for me. What is it that increases their safety in terms of their own psychological development?
Well, first, that's a section in the book where I say up front it's not based on any research. There should have been some research on this, but there hasn't been. It's based on what I heard from parents and from kids themselves, my own experience.
And not to underestimate, you've done an awful lot of interviews with an awful lot of parents and children across America and beyond now.
Yeah. Other than a New York subway, when else do you use all of your senses at the same time as when you're in nature? Again, when we're sitting in front of screens all the time, we're not using all of our senses at the same time, therefore we're not developing them to the full extent. So one of the basic things about being safe anywhere is to know what's going on around you, to sense it. Scientists aren't talking about the six senses anymore. There's at least 30 of them. My son and I were fishing in Alaska going up a stream on Kodiak with a wonderful guide, and he taught us how to smell for bears.
Right.
Yeah. When you're there, what you need to do is make a lot of noise. You don't want to surprise these big brown grizzly bears. You don't want to surprise them. So you sing for bears, you talk, you rattle your bell that you hang on your vest, etc. But then he told us how to smell. Once you've smelled this particular smell, which is a rotting salmon, because they like to roll in it, and musk, bear musk, you don't forget it. If you smell that on one of those overgrown streams, that means one of two things. Either a bear is right there in the bushes next to you, or the bear has been there and has just left. It's informative, to be able to have that sense. And what do you do when you smell bears? You sing for bears. You make more noise. That's maybe an exaggerated explanation of why I think we need to let kids develop all of their senses in nature. Small risks now for a child can avoid big unnecessary risks later.
And build their self-confidence. And I guess it appeals to, nearly 30 years ago now, Howard Gardner came up with this idea of multiple intelligences to give our the sort of fullness of the dimensions of our intelligence rather than a Ubiquitous standard IQ test. And he's more recently added another dimension to his growing list, and that is an eighth intelligence, which he describes as a naturalistic intelligence. Mm-hmm. What is that?
I think it's what we've been talking about, but that's a little tricky. One thing is that Gardner himself says that he never has been able to devote the kind of research to that, to the eighth intelligence, which is the nature intelligence, naturalistic, as he did the others, and he'd like to, but he hasn't been able to. The other problem with that is that suggests that it's a separate intelligence that only some people have. when, in fact, as biological organisms, we all have that intelligence. Now, whether it's surfaced enough, some people have it more than others, but certainly it's there.
Just getting to the heart of the mind in nature, there's an idea called loose parts theory in relation to children's play. What is that, and what does it add to their psychological experience of the world?
The loose parts theory in play theory is that the more loose parts there are in an environment, the more creative the play is, which makes common sense. Kids like to manipulate things. So when there's a lot of loose parts laying around. Now, you could make the argument that a computer game has a lot of loose parts. You're moving things around on the screen. The problem with that environment is that it only goes so far. That environment was created by a couple programmers who had had a lot, way too much caffeine and, you know, been up night after night and eating a lot of pizza. And their view of the world is going to be somewhat limited both by the technology and the fact that no matter who makes the environment, it is limited by human limitations. But when you go into a natural environment, that's where the most loose parts are. I mean, when you see a tree, when you see the life forms that are in the dirt right below the surface, it's everywhere, you know. So that kind of environment is a creative environment for children.
Sticks, stones, yeah. Things, yeah. They can throw at each other.
Right. And we make attempts to recreate that environment. And I mean, play space designers, for instance, it's loose parts theory, they're trying to do more with that by putting big plastic boxes that kids can move around, et cetera, and some of the new playgrounds. That's good. But what if more and more of the play spaces were natural and had the loose parts of nature involved? And even in urban places, that can be done now. There's a lot of new technology or new approaches to this that can make those places quite hardy.
But at the heart of your argument, there's a regulatory and legal argument as well, because we've kind of legislated and regulated loose parts out of the world. And you've come up, over your years of research and engagement with communities, with some extraordinary examples of how we've been doing that.
Yeah, and I don't know how much this is happening in Australia. I suspect it is, but in the newer housing developments, almost all housing developments built in the last 30, 40 years in the United States, are governed by CCNRs, covenants and restrictions. They have private governments called community associations or neighborhood associations that really control people's lives in ways that we would never allow public government to do. What color you can paint your house, it's your curtain liner color, it's whether or not you can plant a vegetable garden in the front yard. No, sorry, it's not in the CCNRs. Mm. One woman that I met said that her community association had recently outlawed chalk drawing on the sidewalks, which apparently leads to cocaine addiction or something. I'm not sure. I made that last part up. But, you know, these ridiculous constraints on people. Just try to put up a basketball hoop in some of these neighborhoods, let alone let the kids build a fort or a treehouse. Some of that comes from just the mania for control, because we have a fearful society, certainly in the United States. So people feel like they have to control everything. Another place that comes from, though, is just the fear of, in addition, fear of strangers is fear of strange lawyers. Litigation, the litigious society, everybody's afraid of getting sued for anything.
More so in America, but that's changing here too, I suspect.
That's what I hear, yeah, so be careful.
What gives you reason for optimism? Because you, out of this book came the Children and Nature Network, which is now epic, it sounds like, across the states. Yeah. What gives you hope, and what is the Children and Nature Network doing?
Well, first, a lot is happening. Children and Nature Network is a nonprofit that was created out of the book to extend the work of the book. So many people were coming forward and saying that they wanted to do something in their own communities, so we figured there needed to be a kind of a clearinghouse of ideas and a map to show what everybody's doing, et cetera, and the news, the latest news, and there wasn't any place like that on the web, so we created that in addition to bringing people face-to-face. There's now over 71 regional campaigns, and that, by region, I mean it can be a whole city, it can be a whole state, it can be provincial in Canada, and these major campaigns are bringing together people who normally might not want to be in the same room. Conservatives, liberals, doesn't seem to matter. They all want to tell me about the treehouse and when they were kids. So this really transcends some of the political and religious barriers in the United States. And so that's happening, and there are these major campaigns. In addition to that, government has made changes. The new Secretary of the Interior is creating a youth conservation corps to try to get young people engaged. There's now a bill in Congress called the No Child Left Inside bill, which is designed to encourage environmental education and perhaps even get some of those kids outside the school. Governors have reinstated state parks, et cetera. And a lot of this is coming because people really don't want to be in the last generation where it was considered normal and expected to encourage kids to go out and build a fort in the woods or dig a hole and get their hands dirty and their feet wet. That really is happening. It's happening in Australia, too. I know that in Western Australia and Perth, they're going to start a big network there. And I want to be clear here that people were working on this decades ago. And the book has been a useful tool, but in no sense is it the reason for this. It's just a perfect storm, in a sense, a time that we know what we need to do.
But how much of this is a sort of harking back to our own nostalgia about our own youth? Certainly, perhaps every generation has felt that their childhood was more free or more. It's a baby boomer thing,
A
certain nostalgia of freedom about that period between the wars, you know? After the Second World War, I should say.
Well, I'll plead guilty to romanticizing certain parts of my childhood. That treehouse was pretty neat. But when you think about it, for all of human history and prehistory, children went outside and either played or worked in nature for all of their developing years. That has been changing radically just within the last three decades. Now, you can make the case that Industrial Revolution certainly had an effect, and the invention of agriculture certainly had an effect, and this began a long time ago. But the last three decades, that pace of change has been much faster. And so I don't think it's a exercise in nostalgia when you think that 99% or more of our history and prehistory as a species has been spent outside, particularly children, and that's how they learned.
Spent outside, but you know, you were lucky to survive your childhood.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and nobody's pretending that nature's nice all the time. It would be better not to die of frostbite, sure, and there was a downside, and there is a downside to nature. I'm just saying, as organisms, as you know, you can't rush evolution that fast. There has to be some implications in terms of health, psychological health, physical health, and even spiritual health when you change that quickly the environment in which people live.
Parents and people without children are sort of bereft as to know where to start with their lives. Often they've caught up in the chaos of modern working life, and they don't know where to start. You've done a lot of hard work gathering stories of where people start to make some changes in their world and in their lives and in their children's lives.
Well, all of us have to do that. I mean, I struggle with that. I'm on airplanes way too much, and I have to force myself to get outside and go for a hike or go fishing or something. I have nature deficit disorder. So it starts with just the acknowledgement that if I go too long without an experience in nature, I don't feel good. I mean, you can just feel that. So you have to force yourself to do it, just like your kids. But there are new ways to do this. I mean, I'm not pretending we're going to go back to the 1950s anytime soon when you told your kids go outside and don't come back in until the streetlights come on. That's probably not going to return in many neighborhoods.
No, but we do need to shift that profound anxiety, don't we, that parents have about having their children out of their sight.
Yeah, let me give you just one example of what parents themselves have come up with. A couple years ago, I got an email from a father and second grade teacher in Roanoke, Virginia, who had read Last Child in the Woods and some other material, and he and his wife had decided to get their kids outdoors on weekends. So they started going to the park or doing stream reclamation, actually, and a number of other things, going on hikes with their kids. One day, his five-year-old pulled on the dad's pant leg and said, "Dad, how come we're the only family having this much fun?" So the father started reaching out to other families, the mother did too, and before long, they had a huge mailing list. Today, they have over 400 families on their mailing list. They created essentially what we call a family nature club, where families band together, and two, three, five families at a time say, "Let's show up at the park on Saturday and go for a walk, go for a hike." or let's garden, or let's do stream reclamation, something together. What that does is that several things. One is that it deals with a fear issue because there's perceived safety in numbers. Any kind of family can do that. Think how great that would be for single-parent families that have all kinds of logistical issues. Mm-hmm. Any kind of economic background with a family, any kind of neighborhood, it could be inner city, it can be outer suburb, can do this kind of thing. And you don't have to wait for funding. You can do it yourself, and you can do it now. And here's the neat thing. Adults who do that and many other types of new ways of getting their kids outdoors, they receive all the same benefits that their kids do. Apparently a longer attention span, huge stress reduction, a revived sense of awe and wonder. So if this is not a bitter pill, this is something that that makes everybody happier and healthier and maybe even smarter.
Well, Richard Louvre, congratulations on your work, and thank you for joining me on the program on ABC Radio National.
Oh, thank you very much. And, you know, if you lived in my neighborhood, maybe we'd go out and build a treehouse. Who knows?
I spent a hell of a lot of time in trees as a kid. In fact, I didn't actually need any sort of architectural objects or wood or any hammers or nails. I actually had multiple rooms in trees where there were no rooms.
You know, David Sobel told me some research, and I don't know the source of the research, but he said that boys and girls deal with the woods differently. Mm. Boys tend to perceive the whole woods, and they run around over a vast area and stuff, whereas girls have a relationship with a single tree. I don't know how true that is and what the evidence is, but it's an interesting theory.
That concludes this week's show, episode 522, on social and spiritual separation. I hope it's encouraged you to connect either with your neighbors or with the world outside, with the great outdoors. If you feel like downloading any of the materials used to make this show, you can do so at the show's webpage, unwelcomeguests.net/522. All the episodes of the show are available for download in the archive, and I've compiled a list of the readings of Ascent of Humanity, and I've put them in a single place, so you can just download a zip file and have a re-listen to that book. I hope we're going to be doing some more episodes on separation, and then we're going to turn to the positive side of reunion. I'm finding, particularly in 2010, more and more people who are understanding what I'm saying, and they're coming up with their own angles on what is happening. And the fact that mainstream commentators are coming up with fundamental criticism of the status quo, I find very encouraging. Thanks again to Jeff for sending me the first interview. I'm always interested to hear your thoughts and suggestions on the show. I would love in the future for it to be a peer review process, a real dialogue and a feedback, and we can improve the quality, improve the reliability and interest and the relevance of the show in putting forward a positive vision of what lies ahead. I think not very long at all. The changes are already underway. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening. Keep giving all you can. Keep reconnecting to the love of life that is within us all.